let me remind you, we're talking about general relativity. And let me say, we're talking about general relativity as a gauge theory, that is, as a theory of a connection. And that, why I say that will evolve. In the last class, and I'll review this for notation, we went from the Einstein-Hilbert action by a series of steps to the Plavatsky action. And I'll review that at the beginning of this class, make sure we're all on board for that. Then we're going to go from the Plavatsky action to an even cooler action, which is, it doesn't really have a name, but I'm going to call it the Kappa-Biot-Dahl-Jacobson action, because to my knowledge it appeared first there, and you'll see what it is. Then we're going to use that to go to the Hamiltonian formulation for general relativity, and we're going to arrive at the form that was written down by Amitabh Sen and formalized by Abhay Ashtekar in about 1986. And so the main goal of all of this, which is sort of the first part of the class, is to understand to introduce and to understand the Ashtekar formulation, which will be a formulation of general relativity as a gauge theory. Then we're going to talk about the constraints, their interpretation, their algebra, and we're going to talk about some very simple solutions that just drop out, that I hope will go in the direction of convincing people that these are better than the old-fashioned variables. And my microphone is not on, but people heard me anyway, I hope. Did you hear me out there? The microphone off?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So I've always actually wondered, given that we have six microphones hanging down, whether one really needs to wear this thing. But okay, so that's the menu, but that's not the whole menu. After that, we will go to finally the quantum theory and talk about Dirac's proposal for quantum theories with constraints. And I don't know how far we'll get into that, but we'll get some distance into that by the end of the evening, this evening. Okay. So the change of viewpoint that's brought about by Plavatsky and Ashtekar and everything that follows from them is a change of viewpoint into what general relativity is a theory of. So the usual viewpoint is that there's a metric, and general relativity is a theory of the dynamics of a space-time metric, that from the metric, one gets the connection, but one doesn't get any particular, one doesn't get a free connection, one gets the Christoffel connection, which is a function of the metric. It has some form like this. Might as well write it once. I haven't written it myself for decades. I might as well write it once just to show you the kind of ugliness. And then the curvature is a function of that, it has terms like derivatives of the connection plus the connection squared. And the viewpoint changes in two steps. So one step, and here the action, I'll just write the action so that I won't have to write again. The square root of the determinant of minus the term of the metric times the Ricci scalar, minus 2 times cosmological constant. Are you still out there in Western? Because your display to us has changed.
We can't see you anymore. Are you ready?
Okay, but you can hear us. So that was the reverse of the last time. could somebody go and get the tech person? Yeah, that guy at the theater. Okay. I will keep going. At least, oh, there you are. We see you now.
That's Guelph.
Oh, that's Guelph. Okay. So something is afoot. We are getting our tech person. As long as I'm reviewing, I'll keep going. And hopefully in a minute we'll, hopefully you can get by on the words if you can hear. Okay. So the first change of viewpoint is what's associated with Palatini. Although, to be fair, this is also associated with Cartan. And this has two parts. One of them is we go from the metric to the frame field. EA, EUA. And the idea is that we represent the same information. Now we can see me here, which is redundant. We represent the same. Great, okay. We represent the same information as in the metric in the frame fields by, and the idea is that the information coded into the metric by the equivalence principle is that there are a set of reference frames for which special relativity is true to zeroth order. So it works now. Oh. Okay, good. And the other change of perspective in Palatini is that the connection goes to a connection I called A, which is free. So whereas the action for the Einstein-Hilbert action is a function just of the metric and its derivatives, the action in a Palatini case is a function of the frame fields and this Yang-Mills-like connection for called A. And the action looks like EA wedge EB wedge F CB minus 2 the cosmological constant EA wedge EB wedge EC wedge ED times epsilon AB CD. And I hope everybody is happy by now with differential form notation. Okay. So in this perspective, general relativity is a function of a frame field, which is almost the same as the metric, and a connection independently. And we only get the relationship between the connection and the metric as a function of the equations of motion, as when we solve the equations of motion. Now, we then make a change of perspective to Plobansky. And in Plobansky, the theory is a function of a connection variable, and half the connection variables of the other, of the Palatini-Cartan. The Palatini-Cartan, the connection is free, but it lives in the Lorentz group, SO13. Now the connection just lives inside of SU2, and so the whole object is, right, and sorry, it should be, I mean, you were still on space time. AMU is an SU2 matrix, and that can be written as AMUI times the Pauli matrices tau I, which are SU2 matrices. And we have another degree of freedom, which is just a two-form B E nu, or a two-form valued also in SU2. So the metric has disappeared. And what we get from that is an action that starts off like B wedge F. It then might have a term minus the cosmological constant over 2 B wedge B. And so far, that just looks like BF theory, which we studied before, the theory with no local degrees of freedom. So this is an action which is a function of B and A. And then we implement a Lagrange multiplier, and we add minus 1/2 a Lagrange multiplier phi ij, sorry, bi wedge bj, where phi's are trace free, so that the action is a function of these phi fields, which are 5 degrees of freedom, the gauge field, and the two form, and the metric has completely disappeared. General relativity is no longer a theory of a metric. It's a theory of a connection and a mysterious two-form object, and an even more mysterious multiplet of scalar field, phi. If you really want to, you can implement it by a Lagrange multiplier like lambda phi ii, just like that. But you don't have to. It's so simple, you don't have to. But if you want to do the whole thing, you could implement it just by adding a Lagrange multiplier to the action. Okay. And as I said before, it's natural to combine this term and this term. And so this is the form we usually present it. So it's the form I'll use, minus just, so I just make the trace of phi d lambda. And so it just has the simplest form, d I with d j. And now the constraint is that the trace of phi is equal to, and in most, if I had been worrying about factors and signs, it's actually minus lambda. So I guess let's put a plus there. Okay, so this is the Fibonacci action subject to the constraint trace of phi at every point of the cosmological constant. And that's where we got last time. Let me start today by reviewing the equations of motion. Then we're going to do one more transformation to get rid of some of that information. And then we're going to go to the Hamiltonian form. Yes. I'm sure I lost a factor of 2. Yeah, and I'll put it there. Okay. So the equations of motion are, if we vary the b, these are the equations of motion. If we vary the b, we get an equation. Oh, that's why that sign, I'd like to sign the way it was before. Okay. I'm going to put that sign there. And I'm going to make that sign there, which is unconventional. Apologies. Is that the two form F is equal to the phi ij times the two form dj. Then Then we have an equation of motion that says that the covariant derivative with respect to A of the B's are 0. And then we have this equation of motion that says BI with BJ minus its trace part, because we're only allowed to vary the trace free part of phi. And these are 5 conditions. And I claimed and asked you to verify at least one side of that a solution of this is that there exists frame fields such that the B I's are actually gotten by taking E wedge E, EA wedge EB, and taking the self-dual part of that, which just to review means we take EA wedge EB plus epsilon AB CD EC wedge EB with a factor of I here because we have a Lorentzian signature. So the frame fields and hence the metric are introduced as solutions of equations of motion. And the interpretation, see, these are very interesting objects now, and I'm going to give them a name. Such these are called sigmas, and they're called the self-dual two-form of the metric. And it's the metric that's constructed from the frame field in the standard way. So one gets a solution of the Einstein equations. And then this equation says something very interesting. The space of two forms is 6-dimensional. The space of self-dual two forms is 3-dimensional. What this equation says is that we have this SU2 connection. And what the equation says, if I put in all the pieces, is that this SU2 connection can be expanded in terms of, it's a two form, so it can be expanded in terms of a basis of two forms. So in principle, it's something of the form of, I don't know, psi IAB EA wedge EB. That would be the complete expansion. It's convenient to divide it into self-dual and anti-self-dual. So it's equal to some coefficient psi IJ times the self-dual two forms. And there are also the anti-self-dual two forms, so sigma I bar, which is the anti-self-dual two form, which is the same thing with the minus I here. We defined those last time, so I hope that's okay. So a general two form would be a linear combination of the self-dual two forms, which are 3 of the 6 of them, plus some other fields, I'll call them phi bar, IJ sigma bar J. And that would be just expanding in a basis of a two form in a basis of two forms. But instead, what this says is that these are not there. And the interesting thing, as we'll develop it, is that that's the content of the Einstein equation. If you take the complex conjugate, you find that the connection, the complex conjugate of A, which lives in the anti-self-dual space, or if we called A the space of the left-handed SU2 connection. This is the space of the right-handed SU2 connection. Its curvature is some complex conjugate of ij times the anti-self dual we form. But for the real section of the Einstein equations, these are three complex equations for two forms. So it's really 3 × 6 = 18 equations, and these are their complex conjugates. So they have the same, there's no more information in these than these, but there's a lot of information in the fact that the other components are missing. And one can see, and I'll do a little bit of that, but only a little bit of that, that that is the statement of the Einstein equations. Okay. Any questions? That's more or less a review of where we were. And I'm sorry to have taken such a long review, but from here it gets even crazier. Let me just point out, before I get to the Hamiltonian picture, that there's a simple solution. A simple solution is phi is equal to the cosmological constant over 3. So then the trace phi is equal, sorry, times the identity matrix. So phi ij is the cosmological constant over 3 times the identity matrix. Ij, then the trace of phi is the cosmological constant. That tells us that the f's are proportional to the self-dual two form. And then one gets this equation, the Bianchi identity, automatically, because this tells me that D of F is 0, but that's just the Bianchi identity. So these are a consistent set of solutions to the Einstein equations. So I immediately get some solutions, some interesting solutions, without even breaking a sweat. Does anybody know what they are? Okay, well, depending on the sign of the cosmological constant, that's either de Sitter or anti de Sitter. Space time. What else could it be? Well, there's a cosmological constant, so Kauffman space time had better not be a solution. Such solutions where the left-handed part of the curvature tensor is proportional to the self-dual two forms of the metric, okay, are called self-dual solutions. Okay. And in the Euclidean case or the complex case, there's very interesting spaces, moduli spaces of these solutions. In the Lorentzian case, there are just a single solution of either de Sitter spacetime or anti de Sitter spacetime. So there's actually, you can go from here to a very interesting, in the Euclidean or complex case, where there are spaces of solutions, this is a starting point to the study of those spaces of solutions. For the case of de Sitter, anti de Sitter, there's just initial solutions, but they're solutions of a lot of interest, so we'll come back and mention them from time to time. They're cosmological solutions. And this is a class about cosmology, so they're of interest. Okay. I have one more trick to do, and that's following. This action is quadratic in the B field. And the solution of the equation of motion is this. So that implies that B is equal to the inverse of phi ij. That is, I can just invert that. Rather than expanding the curvatures in terms of the self-dual two forms, I could invert that. And this says that we're using the field strengths or the curvatures of this connection as a basis to expand the metric information. So this really means we're making the metric information secondary to the information about the curvature. And then I can plug this back here, and I get an action which is just has this interesting form, Fi wedge Fj times the inverse of phi ij with the 1/2. And now I've gotten rid of the b's altogether. And my action is just a function of this SU2 Yang-Mills field A and this matrix of scalar field phi. Yes. I assume that they're invertible. So it might be that there are solutions on which they're not invertible. And if there are, then this form of the action doesn't make sense. Let me point out that the one solution we looked at so far is not one of those because phi is proportional to the identity matrix, which is invertible. Okay, but there may very well be solutions on which it's not invertible. Sometimes, someplace, like, but. Okay, so this action is almost the end of the road. And it's the end of the road as far as our discussion is concerned. Let me make, as an exercise, it's possible to go one step further and eliminate. So phi has five components. So it's possible to eliminate four out of five and write an action which is a function just of f and a single component scalar field by playing another trick. Okay? But I'm not going to need that, but it is one step further you can go. So this is, I'm going to call the Kappa Viadel Jacobson action, because to my knowledge it appeared first in those papers I mentioned last time in 1988 of Kappa Viadel Jacobson. And it's a very implicit form of the action for Einstein's equations. Let's now look at its equations of motion. So if you vary that, okay, what are the equations of motion? If you vary phi, you have to vary phi within phi inverse. So those equations of motion actually, so you need to know the delta of the inverse of a matrix ij is the same thing as phi ik phi, let me see if I'm going to get this right. You know what? I'm going to derive this in front of you. Okay. Phi ij phi inverse jl is delta il. So therefore, delta phi ij phi inverse jl is equal to minus phi ij, the variation of phi inverse jl. Therefore, the variation of phi inverse jl, I have to multiply by another phi inverse. So that's going to be delta phi ij times phi inverse, okay, let me call this lm, phi inverse, and I convert l, sorry, l, what, there's an equal sign there, apologies, li phi inverse mj. So, if I make use of that, and I vary this action, then I find that F I wedge F J times phi inverse I L phi inverse J M is equal to 0. And I find by varying the connection that the covariant derivative of phi inverse I J F I is equal to 0. So those are the equations of motion. And I don't want to pretend that those are easy equations of motion to work with. The way you go back is you invent an object called B, which is equal to phi inverse F. And then you come back to these equations of motion in terms of B. You just invent, in other words, this becomes a definition of B. B is phi inverse F. And then from these equations of motion, you get that's a definition of B, and you get this and this. Okay. Okay. So any questions? And then we're going to go ahead and make the Hamiltonian theory. So we're going to, I'll just continue. We want to make the Hamiltonian formulation of kappa via del Jacobson. By the way, you might say, oh, this is very pretty. But there's matter in the world, and if you couple matter, you're going to have to go back to the Palatini where there's explicitly the metric, because the terms in the action, if you need to have a Yang-Mills field or a spinner field, involve the metric or the frame field, so you're just going to have to go back. Okay? But actually, that's not true. There are beautiful ways to couple the theory in this form or that form directly to matter just using the fields that are there, that is the B, the F, and the phi. And so, and I'm not going to do that here. You can find that again in the Kappa-Via del Jacobson papers. But if you can do the full coupling to matter in this language. Okay, so we're going to take it seriously, and we're going to make the Hamiltonian formulation. So remember that that means that the four manifold is a three manifold cross time, which is the real line. We're going to take the three manifold compact, so we're not going to worry about boundary conditions. And we're going to decompose the action into a time coordinate, t equals 17, t equals 16, et cetera, and functions on the three manifolds, sigma embedded at the various times. And then if we just look at the Kappa-Zeta delta Jacobson action, there is implicitly here an epsilon. So there's a 1/2, an integral dt, an integral over the compact three manifold sigma. There's an epsilon 0 abc in the wedge product. There's an f 0 a I and an f b c j and a phi inverse I j. And if I can just write that out in a little bit more detail so we can work with it. Actually, the reason, the interesting thing is that, as you see, it's actually now easy to go to the Hamiltonian formulation. There's the fewest number of steps. That's why I went all the way to this form. There's the fewest number of steps. So this is the integral of sigma. And F0A, so first of all, epsilon 0 ABC is the same as just epsilon ABC, the form on the three manifold. F0A is del 0, the time derivative of A, minus the covariance derivative del A of A0 times FDC J, and there's an I here and an I here, and a phi inverse ij. So that makes it very easy to see what the momenta are. And let's see, I have messed up my usage of blackboard, so we're going to go over there. Okay, so let's look at what the various canonical momenta are. Well, the canonical momenta for pi, for the a's, I'll call them pi ai's, delta s, delta a dot ai, and that is just epsilon abc fdc j phi inverse ij. So those are the momenta of the spatial parts of the a's. The momenta for a0, as usual for gauge theories, is 0. And the momenta for the phi's are degrees of freedom, ij, the variation by the time derivatives of the phi's, are 0. So all of those are primary constraints. So we'll call these pi phi, these pi 0, and then let's write constraint. I'll call it E, I A, which is pi ia, I'm just rewriting this, minus epsilon abc fbcj pi ij, and it's the inverse of pi ij, and there should be a 1/2 still there, like there was a 1/2, and there's a 1/2, which is nice because there's a 2 in the summation of bc and bp, both anti-symmetric. And So we have 5 plus 9 is 14, plus 3 more is 17 primary constraints. If we write now the Hamiltonian is already in the form of PQ dot. The Lagrangian is already in the form of pi A dot minus A zero, if I integrate this by parts, times a constraint. That is, if I define another constraint, GI, which is the Gauss's law constraint, then the Hamiltonian, which is pi I dot, and I'm going to just add plus constraints, minus the Lagrange multiplier, is just the form of integral A0 I times GI, the Gauss's law constraint. It's not really yet the Gauss's law constraint. So let me say that this is G in quotes, where G in quotes is the divergence of epsilon F times pi inverse. That is, all this stuff with under the constraint is pi, is what's sitting here after I integrate by parts. So the Hamiltonian looks like it wants to be a linear combination of what looks like they want to be the Gauss's law constraint. Now, I'm not going to go through every detail, but I'm going to tell you what happens if you go through the procedure that we've gone through. If you go through the procedure that we've gone through, then these three, well, let me not touch those yet. Okay. The pi phi's and these can all be reduced. And they can all be reduced by eliminating everywhere the phi. If we eliminate everywhere the phi's and we replace, for example, everywhere we solve this constraint by everywhere we see it replacing F times pi inverse in terms of pi, then this indeed becomes the Gauss's law constraint. Then we've solved these constraints. And we're solving these constraints because we're eliminating the phi. So if I can succeed in eliminating the phi and making a theory which is just a function of the A's and the pi's, then I can set these constraints to zero, which are 5 constraints, along with the 5 constraints that I get from eliminating the fives. So that's my goal, is to eliminate the 5. But eliminating the fives is 5 equations. And this constraint is 9 equations. So if I want to eliminate the E's from solving for the phi's, I'm going to have to do it up to 4 additional constraints. You understand? I want to eliminate these 5 here. Actually, you know what? We're not worrying about A0 and pi0. So I want to eliminate these 5 here, and I want to eliminate these 9 here. I want to eliminate these 9 here by solving for the pi and for the phi and getting rid of them. But there are 9 equations here and only 5 phi's. So that's going to leave me 4 equations left over. Okay? And those 4 equations are going to be additional primary constraints. So let's see what those 4 equations are. And if you stare at it for a while, you'll think it's impossible. You can never do this, but if you stare at it a little longer, you'll realize it's almost trivial. So has anybody stared at it long enough? Okay. Look, so supposing I write F, I'm just going to start writing things that are simple to write. Supposing I take, and remember, by the way, this starts out looking like the F theory. And the F theory starts out with constraints that the Fs are equal to lambda, epsilon, A, B, C, are equal to the pi. So remember, we had these constraints, F, A, B, I. Don't get confused. This, in this box here, is a different theory coming to haunt you. It was the constraints from BF theory, of which there were also nine of those. 3 times 3. Okay? So, if you stare at that and you think that what we have is something which is not quite the F theory because of the equations of motion of the phis. So now we're trying to get rid of the phis. So you'll see, I'm just going to, it's easier just to write it down and check, and then you'll see the relation to these constraints right here. Okay? So let me take the F, let me be optimistic and say that the constraints are going to be polynomial. Okay? So let me consider what I can make of F alone. Well, F alone will land me back here. And there are too many F. I'm looking for 4 equations. Okay? And F, there are 9 F's, and I don't, you know, there are 3 in these spatial indices and 3 in the SU2 indices, so I can't do anything with that. Okay? So let me introduce a pi. Well, I can do something there. I can trace there and there. Okay? So now I have 3 equations because I just have 1 more free index. So I have 3 equations. Well, what do I have? Well, my E's tell me that I can express the F's in terms of pi's. Okay. My E's tell me that F BC is epsilon ADC pi A, this is a J, this is an I, times phi IJ. So let me plug in for the F. So I plug in for the F, and I get epsilon A B C pi B pi C I J phi I J using the E's. But look, this is anti-symmetric in B and C because of the epsilon. Therefore, it's anti-symmetric in terms of the I and J up here. But that's 0 because the phis are symmetric. So this is 0. And I've just used the fact that the phis are symmetric. Therefore, I have 3 primary constraints that are consequences of some piece of the E. And I'm going to call those D, A, and there are 3 of them. Okay? So I got myself 3 constraints, which are consequences of the equations E equals 0 that the phis satisfy, but the phis have been eliminated. Okay, that's pretty cool. And that's the only thing I can do with an F and 2 pi's. So let me do it once more. Which way do I want to do this? Doesn't matter. Let me do it once more. So I'm going to take an F. I'm going to take a pi. And I'm going to take another pi. What can I do with that? Well, I wanted to find 4 equations. I already found 3 of them. So I want one equation. So let me trace over the spatial index A here, trace over the spatial index B here. I've got two more jk of the SU2 indices, but I have the ability to go epsilon ijk because those are the structure constants of SU2. Okay, so let's look at that. Again, I can plug in for F, my equation for F, which is true when E is true. It says that I can expand the F as linear combinations of the pi's using the pi's. So let me do that. So that is equal to epsilon ABC, epsilon IJK, pi, and let me be careful here. Oops, this is, I'm being dumb to begin with, epsilon ABC, pi A. Now this epsilon, this I, J, and K were already here. So this is actually phi I, and I need another index L. And then I have, oh, and this should have been C, I apologize. Then I have pi A, J, and pi B, K. So here I have three pi's and two epsilons, and this is open. Oops, and I forgot phi. I'm dumb. The phi that ties the thing up is phi I L. Okay, that's right, because F is pi times phi, so a phi is left over. Now, notice what I have here. I have three pi's, which are 3 by 3 matrices, and two epsilon, which anti-symmetrize them, but I have remaining over an I times an L. So this is some tensor, I'll call it WIL. And WIL is equal to epsilon IJK, epsilon ABC, pi AL, pi BJ, pi CK. Okay, now, if you stare at that long enough, you see that there's only one thing that that can be. So it's a tensor in I and L. Okay. It's, if you stare at it long enough, you'll see that it just has to be proportional to delta IL times the determinant of pi. The determinant of pi is what you would get if you tied up the I and the L. And there should be a 1 over 3 factorial here. And there's some, and I have not been consistent about numerical factors in the numbers of places, so I'm not going to even try. If you, again, if you want a homework, you can fix the numerical factors. Okay, and you can check this, that W has to be proportional to the unit matrix times the determinant of pi. You can certainly check that they have the same thing. Okay. And then you have to make an argument about how many invariants of 3 by 3 matrices there are, which is an argument that you can find in Kapovia, Del Jacobson, or Blavatsky. Okay. So now what do we have? What we have is FAD I pi AJ pi BK epsilon IJK minus Well, this is proportional to delta, which gives us a trace of 5. And the trace of 5, remember, is the cosmological constant over 3. So, I'm sorry, not over 3, it's a cosmological constant. So this becomes minus lambda times determinant of pi is equal to 0. And that's an equation which is true by virtue of the relationship here, E equals 0, between F and pi. So we're going to call that, give that a name, we're going to call that C. That's a single equation. So we're going to put a box around that. Okay. So let me pause. Something I haven't been bothering you with is density weights, but I promised a long time ago to bother you with density weights. So let me go back and bother you with density weights. Momenta are always densities because they come from the variation. That is, they come from delta of an action, which is a scalar, is an integral of something times a variation, delta A dot. And this something has to be a density because it's integrated. So if I remember to put twiddles over densities, all the pi's are density of weight 1 everywhere. Therefore, this object E is a density. And indeed, epsilon tensors upstairs are densities. The Gauss's law constraint, which once I'm now happy that I can eliminate phi and use this equation that epsilon F phi inverse is pi, this is really pi, and that's the density. This object here is a density of weight 1 because it just has an F, which is a tensor, times a pi, which is a density. And this object that we've just defined is a density of weight 2, so it gets 2 twiddles on its loop. And indeed, the determinant of pi, when pi is a density of weight 2, because this count of 1, 2, 3, minus 1 for the epsilon downstairs, is 2 density weights. So this is an object which is density weight 2. Okay? Any questions? Now I have to start erasing. So if you follow the same rules we followed before, for the variational principle of the Hamiltonian theory to be the same as the variational principle of the Lagrangian theory, which were these equations of motion here and here, which by a long train of deductions are the same as the Einstein equations, that is, have the same solution space as the Einstein equations, at least as long as all the tensors involved are non-degenerate, we have to have now a Hamiltonian, which is a linear combination of the constraints. So there's a constraint lambda I times Gauss's law. There's a constraint N times this constraint H. And since this is density weight 2, this N is density weight inverse 1. And there's a constraint, which is a vector field, times the D. The D is density weight 1, so that's right to integral, to integrate. So that's the Hamiltonian. And we have 4 constraints. So we eliminated, we solved 9 equations. the E's, we solved 9 equations, eliminated the 5 phi's, and we're left over with 4 equations, which are the D's and the C's. And now we have to consider that this is a consistent set of constraints. We're not done yet, but that's where we are at the moment. Okay? And we've achieved our goal of eliminating the phi's and their canonical momenta. So this Hamiltonian lives on a phase space, and we've eliminated the pi zero and the a zero. So this Hamiltonian lives on a phase space, which is just a function of the spatial parts of these connections and its canonical momenta. So by the way, this just looks like a gauge field. This looks like the theory of a gauge field and its canonical momenta. Other people sometimes refer to the canonical momenta of a gauge field as an electric field. And sometimes I will do that and call the pi's the electric fields. Okay. Now, notice something. I drew your attention to the constraints of BF theory. And notice what the constraints that we have are. dA is the constraint of BF theory, ABI times traced against the power of the momenta, because in the second term, you're just going to get 0 because of the epsilon. You can check that. And the C is just the constraints of BF theory traced twice against the canonical momenta. So there are 9 constraints of BF theory, and instead here we have 4 constraints. So we have 5 fewer constraints than the BF theory. So we have fewer constraints, so we're not done counting, but there's a chance to have local degrees of freedom. Because the constraints of the BF theory were when we counted them exactly enough to eliminate all the local degrees of freedom, that is, by making gauge transformations that this script F generated, we could set all the A's to 0 locally and set the pi's to anything we like locally. Now we have projected onto just 4 of those 9 constraints. So we have less gauge freedom, less constraints, and maybe we have some local degrees of freedom. Okay? In fact, let's count the degrees of freedom. So we have 9 A's and 9 pi's, which are 18 degrees of freedom. We have 7 constraints, 3 Gauss's law for SU2, 1 of the C's and 3 of the D's, so 3 plus 3 plus 1 is 7. If these are first class, which I haven't shown you yet, if these are first class constraints, then we're going to get to fix 7 gauge fixing conditions, giving us 14 total constraints, and 18 minus 14 is 4. Which is interestingly equal to 2 plus 2. And the linearized gravitational field, we know, has 2 degrees of freedom for the 2 polarizations of spin 2, and we would want 2 more for their conjugate momenta. So this is the right number of degrees of freedom per point to be a theory of a massless gauge field, whether spin 1 or spin 2. This doesn't tell us whether it's spin 1 or spin 2, but it tells us that we have a theory which has 2 polarizations per point or 2 polarizations per momentum mode. So the counting is encouraging. Okay, now, what about the algebra of the constraints? Well, the G's work as they have before. The G's are the Gauss's law constraints. And if I define G of mu as just integrating over the three manifold GI times mu I, where mu I are three functions, then the Poisson brackets are G of mu. We did this before, I'm just reviewing. G, say, of mu prime is G of the cross product, the object, which is, if you like, epsilon ijk, mu j, mu prime k. So it reproduces the algebra of SU2. Okay, so we knew that already. We have the SU2 freedom, which is the freedom of making left-handed SU2 transformations in the local frames, in the tangent spaces at each point. And where is my eraser? Okay, so what about the D's and the C? So first of all, some similar notation. So if I take the D and integrate it against the vector field D, let's call that D of D, so that's dA dA, and D is a density, so that's integrable. And let's call C of N, which is an inverse density, the integral of N against C, just to give some notation. And let's start with the D's. And to start with the D's, I'm going to give you a nice little identity to simply check, and that's then I'm going to, the identity will you'll see there's a very nice identity to know. Let me remind you that the Lie derivative by a vector field of a one form is dA del A, so one form, say, AB plus AA del D dA. I think I have the sign right for the Lie derivative of a one form. And it doesn't change if I have three of them. So the index I just goes there. Okay, I mentioned this because of the following. Let me invent an object I'm going to call curly D of D, which is the integral of a vector field. Well, all right. The integral of the Lie derivative of the vector field of my one form A's multiplied by their conjugate momenta. Okay? The Lie derivative of the one form are one forms. Lie derivatives take one forms to one forms. And I just trace, I just contract with the pi's, which are density weighted vector fields, contract on the I's, I get densities which I can integrate, so I'll call that D of V. Now, I've constructed that so that the Poisson bracket of A at a point with script D of V is just the Lie derivative by the vector field of the A. I've constructed it that way. And the Lie derivative, the same thing is true if I take the Poisson bracket with the pi with this object. You can check that that gives me the Lie derivative by the of the pi's. You have to look up what's the right form for the Lie derivative of a density, of a vector density. Okay, so this is by construction. This I would ask you to check. So in other words, this object script V generates transformations of the fields under a diffeomorphism generated by the vector field V. So D of V generates diffeomorphism of the manifold sigma. You can even check that the Poisson bracket of D of V with script V of W is nothing but script D of the commutator of the two vector fields D and W. So please check that. And that tells me that the algebra of constraints of these objects, 3 of script D, replicates the algebra of the vector fields under commutators, which is the Lie algebra associated with the diffeomorphism group of the manifold. So this is the Lie algebra of the diffeomorphism of the manifold. Okay, question? Okay, so that's a nice first class algebra. That's an algebra of which closes under Poisson brackets. What does that have to do with these objects unscripted D? Well, so let me now show you that. And I promised you an identity. I think I spoke too soon. Now is the moment for the identity. The identity is that if I take the curvature of F and I contract a vector field into it, and I multiply by the pi, and I integrate, then what's going on here? What's going on here is that I have here terms and derivative of A and squares in A. And that's a lot like what's going on in here. But there are some terms which differ. The terms which differ, if you work it out, among them are terms which are quadratic in A. There's a term here, AA pi. So the identity is that this is what I mean by D of V. And the identity is that this is the same thing as script D of V plus another term. And that other term is VA AAI, the Gauss's law constraint GI, up to a sign that we can check. Or in other words, that D of V, script D of V, is unscript D of V minus the Gauss's law generated by a lambda, which is that same vector field contracted into the A's. i.e. the object D, which we derived. Let me not be completely lazy. This is a minus. I'm pretty sure, and that's a plus. The object that we derived, the regular D, plus a certain amount of the Gauss's law constraint, is this object script D, which generates diffeomorphisms of the fields on the manifold. So we already know the algebra of the script D's. We already know the algebra of the Gauss's law that generates SU2. So this is first class and this is first class. So we can compute the algebra of the regular D's. And it's going to be some mixture, but still first class. Okay. But what I'm actually going to do, well, sometimes I'll work with the constraints in the form of capital D, I'll call it, and the Gauss's law. And sometimes I'll take the constraints to be the script D plus the Gauss's law. They're equivalent to each other. Okay, so any questions about? So what I'm asserting is that if you know the constraint capital D, which is f pi, and you know the Gauss's law, which is the divergence of pi, if both of those are satisfied, then this constraint script V, which involves the lead derivative of A times pi, is satisfied. Or if the script D is satisfied and Gauss's law is satisfied, then the capital D constraints are satisfied. So what we have here is six first-class constraints, because the script D have a first-class algebra, and the Gauss's law have a first-class algebra. And they generate local SU2 gauge transformations for the Gauss's law and diffeomorphisms on the manifold for the script D, on the spatial slices of the manifold. So I have only one more constraint to look at, which is the C's. Okay, so let's think about the C's. Well, the first thing is that the C's with the Gauss's law is zero. So C of n with the Gauss's law for any lambda is zero, because we know that the Gauss's law constraint generates local SU2 gauge transformations. And the C's are SU2 invariants. They're SU2 singlets, because the three SU2 indices, I, j, k, are tied up with structure constants of SU2 epsilon I, j, k. So this is an invariant under SU2 gauge transformations. And therefore, its change under SU2 gauge transformations is zero. And therefore, it has vanishing Poisson brackets with the generators of gauge transformations. Similarly, C of n with script D of V, I can also get by an argument. Script D generates lead derivatives by a vector field V acting on both of the fields. So it will generate lead derivatives acting on a function of the fields. And therefore, this has to be equal to integral of L of V acting on the C, but I have the C of n's integrated against an object n. So I can integrate, since I'm under an integral, I can integrate by parts. So this has to be, give me the integral of, with a minus sign from the integral by parts of LV on the n, the lead derivatives on the n times the C. This is equal to, in other words, this is minus C integrated against the Lie derivative of the n. So again, it's proportional to the constraint C, so that this is evidence for first class. That is, all that C is the integral, C of n is the integral of the constraint C against this inverse density n, and all that taking the Poisson bracket with script D does is move you by a Lie derivative along that vector field V in the manifold, and therefore it just gives you the Lie derivative of n on V. And again, you can check, but you should believe me because I showed you that the effect of script D on the basic fields A and pi is to take the Lie derivative by the vector field V, and that has to be true then because Lie derivatives act by Leibniz's rule, so it has to be true on any functions on the phase space, which are functions of A and V. So I have only one more thing to check. Which is C with C. So I have to check C of N Poisson bracket C of M. And let's just stare at that. I'm going to actually write that out a little bit. So that's the Poisson bracket of the integral, we'll say, on the manifold V3x of an object. I'm just going to sketch it. It looks like f pi pi of x minus determinant of pi at x. Poisson bracket, something, there's the cosmological constant here, f pi pi. So I'm also going to integrate on y, d3y, f pi pi of y minus lambda times the determinant of pi on y. And so that's a certain amount of computations that I have to do. So what computation do I actually have to do? The pi's with pi pieces go away because pi commutes with pi. I have to worry about f pi pi with another f pi pi so that these pi's at y can interfere with the a's inside the f. And I have to worry about the f in here interfering with the pi's here. In the first term, what's going to happen from the first term? From the first term, I'm going to have something that looks like d3x, d3y. I'm going to have a pi of y. Now, what you should do is you should integrate by parts inside of the x's and to put the derivatives over here on these. So I'm going to have objects that look like derivatives by x, pi at x, pi at x. Then I'm going to have a pi at y from here, because there were two pi's and I just used up one to define the Poisson bracket. I have an f at y, and I have a delta 3 x at y from taking the Poisson bracket of the a that was inside here with the pi. And I'm going to have, and then I have, when I integrated by parts, I was a bad guy. I forgot to say there's an n at x and an m at y. So there's an n at x sitting inside of there, and there's an m at y outside of everything. I have to do that from each side, so I have to subtract the term when I replace n and m by each other. And that's a typical thing I'm going to have. Then there's going to be the terms in the cosmological constant, which I'm going to write. I'm not going to write right now. We'll worry about that in a minute. inside of here, there are terms that look like integral dx. I know we're getting tired. We're all just going to finish this and we're going to break. There are terms that are going to look like m derivative of n minus the reverse, minus n derivative of m from minus the reverse here. This is where the derivative just acts on the end. And then I have something with f and 3 pi's. And this derivative has an index, a. So I have something with 3 pi's and an f, and then I have a delta 3 x and y, which means I can get rid of one of these integrals, and I just have an object with an f and 3 pi's. Then there's going to be some other terms where the derivative acts on the 2 pi's, leaving the n outside. But those terms are going to look like n times m minus n times m times stuff. So those are going to go away. Times stuff. So these are going to go away. So all I have to worry about is these terms. So I'm just going to tell you what happens. After I integrate dy to get rid of the delta, I have an integral d3x. I have an object which is m derivative of n minus n derivative of m. That's a one form. Then I'm going to have the pi's. So let's think about it. We want to get something which overall is a scalar because these were scalars. So we have to get something which is overall a scalar. I got one downstairs index. I got spatial index. I got 3 upstairs spatial indices. And I've got 2 downstairs spatial indices on the f's. And then I got everybody, then I've got 4 SU2 indices. And I got to get something that's SU2 invariant because each of these is SU2 invariant. Okay. So what I get is I get something where 2 of the pi's contract up on the SU2 indices. And they have spatial indices A, B. And that leaves me with a pi and an f left over. And those 2 SU2 indices have to contract up as well. And they have to give me something which has a one-form index to contract to this D. So the only way to do that is to go F, B, C, J, pi, C, J. And that is a D. That's where we put it. That's a D here. And everybody else goes away. So I didn't quite leave myself enough room here. And this is the most important equation of the product. No, I left myself room right here. So the result is that Cn, and there's a lot of other stuff here. There were other terms in the cosmological constant that all nicely go to zero because there are no derivatives to get in the way of the anti-symmetry killing it. So what you get is you get an object which looks like the integral of this object n dam minus m dan times a square of pi ab traced on the SU2 indices times d. And that's the result of the calculation. Now, if you go back a long way through these calculations, I'll say this one thing and then I'll just summarize and then we'll break. This pi pi, if you go back, pi is related to b. If you go way back. And B is related to the self-dual two-forms. So the pies know about the metric. And something that we'll show later is that these two pies together, with three spatial indices upstairs and contracted on the SU indices, SU2 indices, are nothing but the metric of space, QAB, inverse, because these are upper indices. And the object is density weight 2, so it's times the determinant of the spatial metric. So this part is actually information in the inverse spatial metric. Okay, and I think that you deserve a better, more information about that. So we'll do that again. So let me summarize. The Hamiltonian of this theory that we derived and argued was equivalent to general relativity is a gauge theory on a manifold with no background metric. The degrees of freedom are an SU2 gauge theory and its SU2 gauge field and its conjugate momenta or electric field pi. The Hamiltonian is a linear combination of 7 constraints. 3 of them generate SU2 gauge fields, SU2 gauge transformations. 3 of them, up 2 terms in those SU2 gauge transformations, generate diffeomorphisms of the spatial manifold. That is another way to say it is that these 3 Ds on gauge SU2 gauge invariant functions generate diffeomorphisms. And the 7th one, C, is an additional 7th constraint. These 7 constraints have a first class algebra, except it's really what I called, if you remember the classification, a business class algebra. The constraints close, but here we have a function of the degrees of freedom. So they don't close yielding a Lie algebra. They close yielding this function of the degrees of freedom that I argued knows about the inverse metric field. But nonetheless, they close. Therefore, we're done. The theory has 7 first class constraints. The counting I did was therefore correct. It therefore has 2 canonical degrees of freedom and 2 momenta degrees of freedom per point. So it has the right number of degrees of freedom to be a canonical formulation of general relativity. And it has some very nice properties. Let me emphasize that G, you know from Yang-Mills theory, or you've learned has to do with Yang-Mills theory. Okay? And the D and the C are the very simplest things you could write down, which are simple polynomials of the gauge field, which are gauge invariant. They're 1F and 1 momenta, and 1F and 2 momenta, and then added to 3 momenta. So they're very simple polynomial functions. Now, this is the Ashtekar formulation. What we have not done is follow the historical route. In the historical route, the spatial metric are the canonical degrees of freedom. It has conjugate momenta, which are weird objects which live on 3 manifolds, which are called second fundamental forms or extrinsic curvatures. The theory has 4 constraints, which are non-polynomial functions, messy functions of those degrees of freedom. Those 4 constraints have the same algebra as the D's and the C's. And indeed, what Ashtekar did is very laboriously construct a canonical transformation on the original phase space of the theory from the original very messy forms of the theory, which is called the ADM for Arnowitz, Deser, and Misner form of the theory, to the simple polynomial function of the variable. And so I'm not going to suggest that you do it. It is a tour de force What I did in front of you, now granted I skipped some steps and I waved my hands, but I hope I made it plausible. What I did in front of you is derive the Hamiltonian from the Lagrangian and check the algebra of the constraints. And I did it in sort of an hour and a few minutes. Okay. Skipping some steps and pointing to things you have to check. To do the same thing in the ADM variables, if you at the same level of detail, is five times maybe, at the minimum is five times the work if you know what you're doing, if you've done it before. It's for example, it's the single exam problem in the quantum gravity course that's taught at Imperial College, and everybody knows that that's the exam problem. And so everybody cribs it. Because there's no way to do it in 3 hours if you haven't practiced and memorized the steps of the derivation. Similarly, what Abhay Ashtekar actually did in his paper, which is construct by hand a laborious canonical transformation from that phase space to these variables and check everything along the stage of the way, was a laborious tour de force. And I will be telling you something about, there are some interesting pieces of information that you get from doing that, but we're certainly not going to try to replicate that here. The lesson, I believe, and I think a lot of other people believe, is that the dynamics of general relativity is much simpler when expressed as a theory of gauge fields than when it's expressed as a theory of metrics. When expressed properly as a theory of gauge fields, it's polynomial. It is indeed the simplest theory you could write down, which is a function of gauge fields, which is diffeomorphism invariant, except for topological field theories. And indeed, as we saw in the development, it's closely related to topological field theories. Its constraints are projections of the constraints of topological field theory. And the action, I think I've destroyed this, but the action just differs from the action of a topological field theory by some quadratic equations in the theory. So there is a belief demonstrated by many, many, many results, both classical and quantum mechanical, numerical simulations, et cetera, that this insight is useful and that the theory of space and time is much simpler when expressed in terms of Yang-Mills-like variables because there's a deep insight there into the dynamics of space and time. That is, there's a belief that this is not an accident when you have two ways of writing the equations of a theory and one of them is horrible and non-polynomial and full of inverses and determinants of inverses and messy things, very messy things. And the other is a simple, involves nothing more than a simple cubic polynomial. You would think that the latter is a more insightful formulation of the theory. Okay, so let me pause there. Let's take a 15-minute break. After, any questions? Okay, questions from Western or Guelph? Hello? Everybody's gone? Okay, thank you. So we'll be back at 9 o'clock and we will start talking about, I'll talk about a simple solution and then we'll talk about the quantum mechanics.